Discerning Hearts provides content dedicated to those on the spiritual journey. To continue production of these podcasts, prayers, and more, go to discerninghearts.com and click the donate link found there or inside the free Discerning Hearts app to make your donation. Thanks, and God bless.
DiscerningHearts.com presents St. Therese and Marie, a story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher. Father Gallagher is a member of the Oblates of the Virgin Mary, a religious community dedicated to retreats and spiritual formation according to the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola. Father Gallagher is featured on several series on the EWTN television network, including Living the Discerning Life, the spiritual teachings of St. Ignatius of Loyola. He's the author of numerous books on the teachings of St. Ignatius of Loyola, as well as on the teachings of Venerable Bruno Lanteri, founder of the Oblates of the Virgin Mary. St. Therese and Marie, a story of two cousins with Father Timothy Gallagher. I'm your host, Chris McGregor.
I'm going to move ahead a few years now, and we move to the year 1903. At this point, Marie is 33. And at this point, her illness is pronounced enough that she can no longer join the community for the divine office, and only rarely from this time on will she join the community for that kind of prayer. She has 1 year and 8 months left to live. And she, like Therese, she will die of tuberculosis. And it's a long, painful Calvary that she will walk over the remaining 1 year and 8 months of her life. You remember how we mentioned the milk diet that Therese had to undergo? Marie has this in each of these years, sometimes for months at a time. And she has ups and downs. She has times of greater pain, and then she has times of a partial improvement. It's the up and down that we've seen with Therese, although here it's a longer process. It takes place over, as I say, a year and 8 months.
Does Marie, in her suffering, is she allowed to have morphine at least? Because in this conversation, that does come up not only in surrounding Therese's death, but also in the Mother Prioress's passing.
And here is what one author writes about this issue. Interestingly, she herself refused any painkillers to alleviate her suffering, but upon the persistence of the community, she consented at the end to take some narcotic relief. This would be in all the writing on Marie, I have never seen the question directly addressed, was she also given morphine? My guess would be that she was, because not only was the former prioress no longer in the picture, but she herself, the prioress, had consented to this in the extremity of her death from cancer. So my guess would be that it was, but I do have to say I've never seen that point addressed directly in any of the writing. I would guess it all the more because those who accompanied Therese, her sisters, Sister Marie of the Trinity, and so on, they would have given anything to have been able to administer the morphine injections. And as I've said elsewhere, they actually did slip just a little bit of morphine syrup into some of what she was drinking. But it's hard to imagine that at this point and in the changed circumstances, she would not have received that. You know, it's like treatments that are just appearing now and we're hesitant about them, but 10 years from now, people will wonder, well, why did they hesitate? It's just that it's new, people aren't sure of it. There's also the question in the prioress's mind of what is appropriate, you know, for religious. At this point, there would be no hesitation at all, you know, in using these things in a proper medical way, obviously. All right, I'm going to quote just one letter from this year, 1904. And because it's something that I found in Marie's letter and that I've actually quoted on a number of occasions. Remember how I said that in these years of her life, sometimes you'd kind of wonder, well, who's writing here? Is it Marie or Therese? Because of the similarity of content. I think you can tell in the difference of style, but in the similarity of content. And this is a letter to her friend, Céline Potier, that is Céline Maudelonde, who at this point is married, has two young daughters, lives not far from Lisieux, And she has really turned to Marie as her spiritual director. And I mentioned the 73 letters of Marie to her that we have from these years. And if you read them, what you see is Marie becoming, at first a bit hesitantly and tentatively, but with increasing sureness, become a spiritual guide for Celine. And you see how deeply she has assimilated much of what she's learned from Thérèse and also from her own sufferings, which have been a real school for her. Now, in this letter, so this is February 14th, 1904. Marie has about a year to live at this point. And Celine has written, and obviously from what Marie replies, Celine is in a time of some illness. She's been experiencing physical pain. And there are various privations and trials that she's going through at this time. And she's saying to Marie, I don't really bear these very well. I rebel. I don't carry them very well. I don't have the same kind of spirit of renunciation that you have in Carmel. So I'd say here, Celine is every one of us. Celine Potier is every one of us. Yes, okay, I try to put up with the sufferings and the trials and the worries and the pain and the burdens, but I complain, I rebel, I don't do it very well. So how is Marie, the former scrupulous woman, going to respond to this? And what shot through all of this is music. As we've seen, Marie is an accomplished pianist and just a beautiful singer. And my guess from the letter is that Celine also probably has taken music lessons. And apparently her daughter, little Marguerite, who is 9 years old at this point, is very likely taking piano lessons as well. So Marie gives her answer couched in musical terms here. So, okay. Doesn't your soul always sing the canticle of abandonment, fiat to the will of God? So aren't you, you're so resigned. All right, but then I hear you objecting. I hear you say to me, oh no, very often I revolt inside. Okay, how do you respond to that? Darling little Celine, there may be wrong notes in the execution of your piece. And then I just find this comparison a beautiful thing. But tell me, if your little Marguerite on any occasion played you a piece of music, she would have learned to surprise you. And didn't play perfectly, would you blame her? Would you reproach her for it? Oh no, your maternal heart. So she's writing to a mother. See only her goodwill. You would be touched by this surprise she offers you, and you would reward her as if she had executed her piece to perfection. Okay, and Celine knows that's true. Of course, she embraces her. It's just beautiful. I'm so proud of you. Now the application. Oh, my Celine, the good Lord has an even more tender heart than that of mothers. And that's something just to stop and think about. We've seen Thérèse say this already, that in one of the poems, you know, the God who can create, and there she's speaking about the love in a father's heart, but can easily expand it to the mother's heart. The God who could create that love must have a heart that is so much more tender and loving than that. The Lord has an even more tender heart than that of mothers. If you happen to weaken, he acts with you as you would act with one of your children, and that in all the circumstances of your life, pains of all kinds, the most painful trials. I beg you, always look at the Lord as a tender mother. So this is Marie. It's a lovely message, but it's also an insight into her spiritual maturation that's going on through the, call it the crucible of suffering and growth, and with the wisdom of Thérèse to help her. If your little girls have pain or suffering, they always turn to you and trust their pain to you, and you console them. If they have a fault, they ask your forgiveness. And what do? Well, obviously, you forgive them, you hug them, and you encourage them. Well, the good Lord does even better than you. Isn't that consoling? And then just a brief reference to her illness. You'll find this in most of the letters at this point, but I'll read just a couple lines to make a further point here. I am always getting better. And if you read the letters, you'll see that through this last year and 8 months, Marie will always say this. She'll always want the person she's writing to know that, yeah, maybe there were struggles, but things seem a little better now. And there's a maturity in that as well. She's not just plunged into despair or discouragement because of her illness, but she's constantly trying to put the best face on it that she can for the sake of others. I am always getting better, but the weakness is always very great. As for the chest, it's better. I'm still coughing, but I'll be coughing for a long time, it seems. I'm still much better. I can take care of myself now, which means that earlier she was too weak to do that. But I haven't resumed my ordinary life yet. I have to be very careful. The slightest cold makes me cough. Just going to take one more thing. This is from the circular letter that Pauline wrote after the death of Marie. We've mentioned this, that this is the custom of the Carmels. And it's you can also find that on the website of the Archives of the Carmel of Lisieux. And just one thing I want to quote from this. I think I may have very early on mentioned this, but this is its setting now. And Pauline is describing Marie's struggles with scruples through her life. And she says that Marie fell into this to suffer cruelly from it until her last illness. Until her last illness. And it'd be interesting to know exactly what Pauline means by that. Does she mean that she finally overcame this in her last illness? And if so, what does she mean by her last illness? Does she mean the year and 8 months that we're describing? Not exactly sure, but what it says is that at least up until that final illness, she suffered, as Pauline says, cruelly from scruples. So Marie herself comments on this. She said, agréablement, pleasantly, agreeably, warmly, whatever adjective you use there. She said, Thérèse spends her heaven doing good on earth. So this is, what is this now, 8 years after Thérèse's death. Thérèse spends her heaven doing good on earth, but she takes care of all needs. She is universal. Scrupulous souls, that will be my specialty. I will spend my heaven consoling them. So if any of us is burdened by worries and doubts and trials of this kind in the spiritual life, in the communion of saints, I think you have a wonderful older sister to turn to with that. There is a photo that is undated, but comes from this time when Marie is ill enough that she's in the infirmary. My guess would be that we're probably well into the final year and 8 months at this point. And Celine would have taken, her sister, Thérèse's sister Celine, would have taken the photo. And I warmly encourage anyone who is following these podcasts to take some time and just look at this photo. I've spent a fair amount of time myself looking at it, and you don't tire of it. So this is in the infirmary, and Marie is in her infirmary bed, and she's covered with blankets, maybe up to above her waist, and there, the upper end of the bed is raised like a hospital bed would be, and there's a pillow there so that the upper part of her body is not quite horizontal, but is raised the way you'd see a patient in a hospital bed. Obviously, the photo is set and prepared. Marie is wearing her nun's veil, as much of her as you see. She's wearing her habit. And bending over her is Pauline, who took care of her in her final illness. Again, she was also attended by her sister Jeanne's husband, Francois, the doctor, who also visited Thérèse, as we've seen.
Now, he would have had to come up from Cannes, wouldn't he?
Well, what happened was that when Marie's mother, Céline, dies, now Isidore is alone in the house in Lisieux, and they didn't want that. And they, like every family does, they had to decide what they were going to do about it. One of the options would have been to have Isidore go up to Caen and live with Jeanne and Francois. That's where he had his medical practice. They were all established there. But it would have meant that he would have had no more contact with his daughter and the Martin sisters who were in the Carmel. So they didn't want to do that. And very generously, what Francois did was he sold his practice, and he and Jeanne moved to Lisieux, and they lived with Isidore, and they took care of him until his remaining years.
Would that mean, Father Gallagher, that they took over the pharmacies?
No, actually, the pharmacy was sold, And this was back just months after Thérèse entered the Carmel. So we're back in 1888. And this is the time when a relative of Céline, Marie's mother, dies and leaves a substantial inheritance to the Guérin family and the Modelon family, the two cousins' families. And from that point on, actually, Isidore is the Guérin family is very well to do. It includes that summer chateau in Lamuse, which the two families share. So when that happened, he sold the pharmacy. And from that point on, he dedicates himself to the family. And also, he gets involved in support of the church in many different activities at that time. So the pharmacy is no longer a part of the family at this point. It's really, really good of François to do this for the sake of Isidore. You can read some of François's letters too, and they're pretty impressive. He has a very profound faith as well. Right? So in the photo, Pauline is also present, and she is standing by the side of the bed and bending over Marie. With one hand is held behind Marie's head, just supporting her gently, and the other is placed upon the blankets over her heart. And if you look at this, Pauline's entire attention is focused simply, uniquely on Marie. And there's a gaze there that I won't even try to describe, but there's something very impressive about it. What I've done, and you can do this if you look at this, I've actually amplified Marie's own face here because it's her gaze that I find so striking. I think if you just look at this, you will learn as much about her as maybe everything we're saying to see this. And I'll do my best to describe her gaze, which I've struggled to find words for.
And we'll have that picture of her in the show notes found in the podcast. So anyone, you just have to visit there and you'll be able to see.
So Marie is looking at the camera. So her eyes are looking directly at you as you look at the photo. The one single word I can find to describe her gaze is poignant. And I'll do my best then to amplify that a bit. There's something trusting in that gaze. She's physically helpless, but she's given over and she's trusting, in this case, Pauline. But I think it's broader than that. There is some sense of suffering in her face, but it's not marked. Something like Thérèse, if you look at the photos, as we've said, throughout that terrible illness, you would not know from the photos of her face that she was suffering such extreme emaciation and all that she was undergoing. And I would say the same of Marie here. You wouldn't know from looking at her face of the seriousness of her illness. And there's something surrendered about her. She's given over. She's accepting. She's not fighting the illness. And there is a complete absence of any agitation anywhere in the gaze. And finally, the best description I can give of this is there's a kind of accepting peace about it. There's no longer any, as I say, desperate resistance and so on. She has accepted it, and there's a peace and there's a trust about it. But there's something I find deeply moving about her gaze in that. All right. Now I'll read from the circular letter that Pauline wrote, just a couple of paragraphs about her last moments. And she dies on April 14th of this year, 1905. At age 35. And here's a nice little detail, as it's very close to the end now. We presented her with her crucifix, so that's her profession, her religious crucifix. Tried to pull out a small flower she had tied there the day before. No wilted flowers for Jesus, she said with a charming smile. The supreme moment was approaching, and the outbursts of our gentle dying sister became ever more expressive and fiery. I'm not afraid of dying. Oh, what peace! One must not be afraid of suffering. He always gives strength. Oh, how I would like to die of love. That's Pure Thérèse. love for the good God. And then her final words are, "My Jesus, I love you." And the soul of our angelic sister, leaving her frail physical humanity, was given up in this act of love. People never cease to come and gaze at our darling child at the choir screen. And in fact, there's a photo of this as well, of the preparation of the body, and they do it in a beautiful way. She's extended the way we do, say, at wakes, and she's wearing her habit. They have placed a crown of flowers around her head. There are other flowers. And what she says is, and so Marie is placed so that people can see her behind the grill. And she says, "For two whole days, people never cease to come and gaze at our darling child at the choir screen. She was so beautiful. She seemed to be having such a sweet dream." And you know, it's really true. People say that the person looks like he or she is sleeping, but that's really what you see when you look at that photo. She really does look like she's sleeping. And again, you don't see signs of ravages of illness on her face. "She was so beautiful. She seemed to be having such a sweet dream. More than 20 priests, a large and sympathetic audience, gave her at her burial a real procession of honor." And now Marie of the Eucharist, that's her name as a sister, rests close to Therese of the Child Jesus, their graves touch like their souls. Because before Therese was exhumed as part of the beatification process, she was buried in a plot in the cemetery in Lisieux that Isidore had actually purchased for the sisters. And so Therese is there and Marie is placed by her side in that cemetery. Now, I want to conclude by saying a few final words about first Therese and then about Marie. The story of two cousins. So what can we say about them? And the words that I'll quote regarding Therese, I'm taking from a talk given by Bishop Guy Gaucher. And this was June 19th, 2005 in the Basilica of Lisieux. As I mentioned, he was made auxiliary bishop of the diocese of which Lisieux is a part, and auxiliary because he was so heavily engaged at this point in the whole work around Therese. He actually lived in Lisieux for the 18 years that he was a bishop, and he also had a position at the pilgrimage center in Lisieux. And of course, as we've been intimating all along, he is doing marvelous work to promote Therese. The main reason why we have much more knowledge about Therese today than, we'll say, 50 years ago, is that he was one of a team of six who published the centenary edition of the complete works of Therese in 8 volumes. And it's marvelous because so much more was made available that was buried in archives until that time. And Bishop Guy Gaucher is very much at the center of this whole project. But he reaches the age of 75 now, and it's time for him to submit his resignation as a bishop. And they have a ceremony for him in the Basilica of Lisieux. And in this ceremony, he gives this talk. And what he does, it's a lovely thing. The last poem that Therese wrote was, "Pourquoi je t'aime, O Marie?" Why I love you, O Mary. And she said that before she died, she wanted to express her understanding of Our Lady. And that is one of the better known of her poems. So what Bishop Gaucher does is to write, "Pourquoi je t'aime, O Thérèse?" Why I love you, O Thérèse, playing off of that. And he describes, I'm not going to go through it, it would take us too long, but this is on the web and it's lovely, how initially he was very unattracted by Therese, some of that sort of pious image of her that I would think that by now anyone who's gone through this set of talks knows is nowhere in the picture. You know, I don't want to be too harsh about that, because without that initial presentation of Therese, the world would have never known of Therese. But it's very beautiful that now that is completed by a much fuller picture of her as the sources have been made available. But then he details how he began to be interested in her and then won over by her. And so, amongst other things, he answers this question, "Why I love you, O Therese. I love you because you are constantly surprising, elusive, puzzling personality. And again, we've seen that, and it's so true. You delight in what you see in Thérèse, but you know there's more. You are nothing like the wooden image that I pictured before. You surprised even yourself by the contrasts in your character. I love you because of your little way, your brilliant insight, which rediscovers the heart of the gospel at a time when Christians were torn apart by a multitude of obligations, duties, and practices, often out of fear, obsessed with the justice of God. You rediscovered all the graces of a child at maturity, a privilege so rare. I love you for your sense of humor. You have no illusions about yourself or those around you. You love the saints who joke, who are always cheerful, who are very fond of their family. That is also why we love you. Just interject there. That's the year that Marie enters the Carmel. And so Marie is a witness to these final years and the full maturation of Thérèse. When you reach maturity around 1895, it seems to me you are finally completely yourself. You breathe life. You freely love nature, flowers, animals, the sky, the stars. But first and foremost, you love mankind, especially the poor in your community. I love you because you are true. That really rings a chord. Everything about Thérèse is truth. Remember how she says, I've never sought anything but the truth. I love you because you are true. Love truth. Fight for it, mercilessly tracking down the prevarications, the small, in quotes, pious hypocrisies. I love you because at the end of your life you entered darkness and took your place at the table of sinners. I love you because you revealed to me the spirit of Carmel, and because through you God has inspired numerous people to surrender themselves to love in the heart of the church. I love you as a sign, a reflection, a proof, in parentheses, what word shall I use, of the merciful love of the Father manifested to the world through Jesus and the Holy Spirit who blows where he wills. I love you because everything you wrote is true, and you always keep your promises, this one among others, I will spend my heaven doing good on earth until the end of the world. And where's my other page here? Oh, here. And then with regard to Marie, and I'm going to take this in part from Pauline's circular letter, some of the things that she says describing Marie, and then I'm going to add some of my own. So from Mother Agnes of Jesus' circular letter, Marie possessed an uncommon intelligence. She was first in her class, and she won all the prizes. She really was very alive intellectually. She had a very limited sense of her own talents and capacities, and she never fully seemed to accept or understand the natural talents that she had. She suffered cruelly from scruples until her last illness, worries, and all the rest of this. She, throughout all of her life, had problems of health, and that from an early age, which certainly affected her in those years, and leads finally to an early death at age 35. She was, Pauline writes, aimable et sérieuse, aimable, kind, with a goodness, a warmth about her, and a certain seriousness about her. Like every human being, I'll just comment here, we're all complex. You can't get any human being fully into one set of categories because serious, yes, but fun-loving and all the rest of that, you really have to put all of this together. Quoting Pauline, she was a little cold at first, perhaps, but her qualities were all the more appreciable because she seemed to be completely unaware of them. In fact, she quotes in that circular letter how Marie, as a young girl, she follows the servant that they have watching what she's doing, learning, because she feels she's never going to be capable of doing anything more than that. She was an accomplished musician. She played the piano well. And she was, quote, gifted with the most melodious and pleasing voice. She was self-effacing, and that's really true. She never puts herself forward. And then, quote, though her exquisite modesty gave her, without her knowing it, an additional charm to her natural gifts. She was a gentle and shy young girl. Gentle is that word douce that we've seen before, which again means warm. A loving heart, a goodness, and a shyness. She could appear indifferent, but that was not at all the case. She would appear that way, quote, because under an extreme reserve, she hid a most sensitive heart. And most sensitive is not an understatement. This is a very loving, passionate heart that she has. She never tired of admiring nature, and you see that in the summers that she spends at the chateau when she just loves being out with the woods and the birds and all. What follows now, these are my comments on Marie, having seen all that we've seen. The word I would use for her is ardent. And interestingly, it's the word that Thérèse uses in the second of the three poems that she wrote for Marie. The poem starts, mon cœur ardent, my ardent, passionate heart overflowing with emotion, with love, with a desire to give itself to love and to be loved. And you could take at random any of Marie's letters, especially in the latter years, and you'll see this, that they're an outpouring of emotion, an outpouring of love. There's an ardor there. She has a great love for her family and for her parents. And great is not too weak a word here. This is so central to her, the deep, deep, deep love that she has for them. You cannot understand Marie without that love for her family, which I guess also gives the measure of the sacrifice she's willing to make, you know, to follow her vocation in the way that she did. She has a sense of humor. She's fun-loving. We've seen that maybe a little to excess, as Thérèse says, in the context of the religious life, but we didn't get into them, but she would write things for the sisters for recreation that were just kind of fun and share them there. There's a real fun-loving sense in Marie. And as she matures in the latter years of her life, she also, I say also because this is so utterly Thérèse, she becomes, I think, increasingly other-centered. In her letters, if you read any of her letters after Thérèse's death, and that's a lot of letters, you get no even slightest hint of I'm burdened by scruples and I'm discouraged and I'm struggling. It's simply completely absent there. You would not know at all from those letters that there was any of that struggle. The one perhaps small insight, and it's just a perhaps here, that you might get is her great desire to be able to meet with her spiritual director, the Abbé Levasseur, whom we've mentioned, whom she got to know in those summers in the nearby parish when they were at the chateau, and who remained her spiritual director. But because he lived about 50 miles away, opportunities to meet with him were very rare. And sometimes you'll see in her letters just a longing to meet with him, and you might suspect that what's going on there is a need to unburden her heart of some worries or scruples. But that's the only way in which you might even intuit that this is present. From the rest of the letters, it's simply she's writing for the person to whom she's writing. And she's giving of herself. You see in her an increasing, and it takes effort. It takes, there's a struggle involved because there's suffering involved. An effort to, her word, it's Thérèse's word, to abandon herself completely to God's will. At one point, she'll say, after it's in the time of her great illness, that the last year was the best year of my life because it's what God wanted, you know, in all of her illness. So you see that, and she's inculcating that to Céline Pottier when she writes to her. There is a very clear desire in her to be a saint. She really wants that. And I'd say, humanly speaking, it's hard to look at her life and not see that she lived, like us, with struggles, but she walked that path, and she certainly died in that way as she entered into the next life. She has a very humble sense of herself. She never considers herself to be anything special in any way, and she's very aware of her struggles and limitations. Quote Mother Agnes again. Mother Agnes describes her as a burning lamp constantly nourished by the oil of suffering, speaking of these last years of her life. So as I look at Marie, and as we conclude here, this was a life of faith. She's not a doctor of the church. Like Thérèse, she's not a canonized saint. But this was a life of faith that was at the heart of everything. It was a heart, it was a life lived by out of a heart that loved, and that increasingly, as the years of her relatively short life went by, increasingly grew in the ability to love. Her life was a yes to God, as complete as she could make it until the last moment of her life. I'd say, to sum it all up, this was a life well lived in this life and unto eternity. And I think the value of looking at Marie and her relationship with Thérèse, and we're not Thérèse, but we can be Marie. We can be a disciple of Thérèse. We love the Lord. We're people of faith. We are burdened by our weaknesses and our failures. We struggle at times. But Marie tells us that, yeah, that's the journey. Walk it faithfully. Never give up. Know that the God with whom you are relating has a heart more tender than the heart of any father or any mother. And in the awareness of our limitations and the sincerity of our desires to go forward with much hope. And I think Marie stands before us as a disciple of Thérèse and as a sign of that hope.
Well, Father Gallagher, it's been such a blessing to have you bring forward this relationship between Thérèse and Marie, and once again to revisit this incredible family, the Martins and Gruens. Just in closing, a question or two, just from your observations in the relationship. For Marie, having the benefit of the counsel of Thérèse, I didn't necessarily hear as much, though I'm absolutely certain it became a part of her daily practice, the little way. It was more, it seemed as though Thérèse had counseled her in that acceptance of love and allowing herself to let go of some of the scruples, as you said, the worries, the concerns, and learning how to trust, which we hear so much in that dynamic of that beautiful poem that Thérèse will write. She's counseling her in that particular arena a little bit more than some of the other things we may be familiar with when it comes to St. Thérèse.
Well, it's a great observation. And I think what that comes back to is Thérèse's understanding that we've quoted along the way, that each person needs to be loved individually. We can't love two, let alone five, whatever number of people, all in the same way, because each person is different. And so for Marie, who is so burdened with scruples, Thérèse is just constantly going to come back to this, you know, move away from that. Center your heart on God's love and on saving souls. With someone like her sister Celine, who is such a much stronger personality, she wouldn't need to do that, for example. But I don't think the things are disjoined, because as Marie becomes increasingly less centered on her own struggles and worries and scruples, she becomes correspondingly increasingly free to love, and that is to live the little way. And that is to put love into every little thing that she does, and to do that with confidence in God that he'll make up for our poverty, and to do that for an apostolic reason, because each of those acts of love is, in the communion of saints, fruitful in winning souls to the Lord. So in a sense, there's an obstacle. We all have them, you know, in various ways. You and I and all of us are our limitations. And as she grows in freedom from the limitation, then she's set increasingly free to live the little way, you know, to put heroic love into the small things, in quotes, small things of every day that God gives us.
Would you say her struggles with scruples is, you know, for anybody, there's a balance, right? If you were to imagine, and on one side is the self-reflection and self-knowledge of ourselves, our awareness of our sinfulness, and on the other side is the needs and concerns of those around us on the other side of that balance. What do they need in our response to love and care and concern? It sounds as though, for Marie, in the beginning anyway, the scruples on the one side of the balance was more tipped. Instead of the self-knowledge, it became too much gazing on the self, too much of what was going on inside of her as opposed to the concerns of others, to turn her gaze from being so harsh on herself. Is that a fair way of expressing that?
Yes, I would think so. I think the using the category of balance, I think, really works in this, because self-knowledge, you know, from the beginning has been understood to be, well, Teresa of Avila calls it the bread we eat every step of the way on the spiritual journey. You know, and for example, St. Catherine of Siena, at the very first sentence of her dialogues, you know, a soul rises up having spent some time in the cell of self-knowledge and so forth. Question is that if the effort to gain self-knowledge decreases our energy rather than releases energy, then we want to take a look at that. And that's kind of what you see in Marie. Now, one thing that's not mentioned very much, if at all, in the sources, is how Marie got to this point. This would be my guess. You have a young woman with a deeply loving, feeling, ardent, sensitive heart. In the spirituality of the time, remember Therese's response, Therese goes through scruples too, you know, especially after a retreat at the Benedictine Abbey, which is all about mortal sin and hell and so forth. And you have this Jansenist-tinged spirituality from which Therese is able to break free, but which is pretty much universal around her. And we owe an awful lot to Therese that it's no longer, you know, dominant. But you have the deeply sensitive heart, and then you have this heavy message of God and condemnation and judgment and who knows if he'll be saved and so forth, striking deeply into the heart of this sensitive young girl. I would guess that in some way, the combination of those two things awakens in her. She just wants to love the Lord, but now she's afraid, you know, awaken within her this set of scruples against which she'll have to deal, you know, struggle so much in the course of her life. So that's a question, and that may be individual for anyone. You know, if a person finds that I'm really struggling a lot with scruples, well, why? You know, what has kind of guided things to this point, and can that be reviewed and looked at in a better way? And could we get some spiritual direction or some help and so forth in doing that kind of thing?
And as you said, she was highly intelligent, so she was a thinker, and she was also an artist in a way, a musician, a vocalist. And I say this with all due respect, I know many those who have that giftedness, and they're hard on themselves. I mean, oftentimes they can be perfectionists, and only because they allow themselves to be out front and they offer something to those around them with their gift, and they get feedback, and it sometimes can be critical. So they're aware of that and trying to prevent that. But then their harshest critic is usually themselves. And so that may have had a part of just her personality, being very hard on herself because of that disposition.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we said, I think you see that in her. She doesn't seem to have an adequate realization of her own talents and giftedness. And so she never sees herself as, you know, a very strong person, so forth in those ways. And I think it's all the more encouraging that's why I've said so often, she's every one of us, because who of us with our different nuances doesn't have that place deep in his or her heart where we feel, whatever the nuance is, God, you would want me up at this level, but I'm down at this level. I'm not everything you want me to be. And that place that we have to deal with too. So I'd say do what Marie did. Open your heart to Therese, which is really, as John Paul II said, simply opening your heart to the gospel and to the infinite love, you know, of the Savior.
Yeah, and I would encourage people to, again, go to the show notes for all the different episodes, and we'll have images that we can find of Marie and, of course, of Therese and the rest of the family. But I have to tell you, I mean, my first encounters with Marie were those images. I remember seeing pictures of her that Celine took of the family, And she so intrigued me. I didn't even know anything about her, but she was the one that was funny in the images. You have everybody very, you know, that pausing for 9 seconds so they can get the shot. But somehow Marie does something in that 9 seconds that captures this engaging personality. And so that's how I came to know Marie, was just, there was something about, I want to know, what is it about Marie? You know, it's almost like the song, how do you solve a problem like Maria? Well, you give her Therese.
Well, that sums up an awful lot of what we've said. We are blessed to have photos of Marie from a very, very early age up through and then even after her death. So I've said a number of times, and I think it really does help an awful lot. You can't, as I've said before, you can't look at those photos and not like her. And you're right, Chris, that she's the one who in the photos, sometimes it's not a full smile because you can't hold that for 9 seconds, but there's a little half smile there when everyone else looks more serious. And there's something very engaging about it.
Yeah, you just know, after you know it's her, you spot her in everyone, and you wonder what she's going to do and how she's going to get the attention on that, you know, to kind of break out of the set piece. And so I'm so grateful that you have brought her forward. And I look forward to maybe hearing from people who have had an opportunity to pray with her, to get to know her story, to learn from her lesson, and how she allowed Therese's counsel to change her life.
And that same counsel can bless ours. I'll just conclude by saying that, obviously, I've spent a lot of time, you know, in getting to know the sources and so forth. And it's just personally been very nourishing and sometimes quite stirring. Really grateful to have had the opportunity to dive into Therese and Marie and their world in this way. It's just very uplifting and encouraging.
Well, once again, we look forward to the next time we can visit the Martin family, because knowing St. Therese, she's probably going to put another aspect of that diamond of a family on your heart. So until then, Father Gallagher, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
You've been listening to St. Therese and Marie, a story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher. Be sure to check out the comprehensive summary and reflection questions contained in the show notes for this episode. To download this particular episode, along with hundreds of other spiritual formation programs, visit discerninghearts.com, or you can find them within the free Discerning Hearts app or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission, which is to offer authentic and rock-solid spiritual formation freely to souls around the world. And if you feel us worthy, please consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax-deductible, to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for St. Therese and Marie, the story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher.